Hey, welcome. Thanks for downloading Garden Fork Radio. This is me, Eric. I'm your host. I have a YouTube channel and this podcast. It's all about eclectic DIY. Today, we're going to have the resident Garden Fork agronomist on, Scott. He knows more about soil and growing things than you and I together. And we're going to talk about raised beds, soil tests, local soil amendments, and more cool stuff. So welcome, sir.
Hello.
So Scott, full disclosure, Scott is a patron of Garden Fork, and we interact regularly. And you were on the show a while ago, and I actually looked through our emails. It's taken me a month of getting my act together to schedule a time for us here. So thanks for your patience.
Yeah. Well, I think it might have been Will had said that he just finally just emailed you or said, here's the time. Does that work? And that's kind of what I did. And it finally worked. So,
so you've learned.
Yeah.
So for people new to the show, what is an agronomist?
Agronomy is the study of crops and soils. So a botanist might be looking at any type of plant or any type of, you know, like looking more at plants or at how they work. Agronomy, I guess, would be applied science. So you're taking stuff that you know about biology and botany and soils and putting it together to grow crops. So that's it in a nutshell.
And so your career, you're working with basically large farms and how to basically grow their crops better.
Yeah, and it would be like it'd be a similar concept of what a veterinarian is to animals, even like a and of course like there's you know in. There's veterinarians that would run like small animal clinics, and so they're going to more see pets and urban, you know, be in a more of an urban environment. But then there's the farm vets that take care of only farm animals. So it'd be a similar concept that agronomy is more on the plants and soil side.
All right, cool. So I was really intrigued because I was talking with Erin from the Impatient Gardener about raised beds, and she was talking about amending the soil in her beds because the soil level drops. And in my raised beds, the soil level almost never drops. And I put some stuff in there, you know, amendments and that, but, and then you emailed me and said you had some thoughts on that. So I've been waiting for a month now to hear what this is.
So I was looking at her post, and I think it said that she got some type of special raised bed mix, it looked like.
Uh-huh.
She wasn't quite sure what, I didn't say all what was in it, but it looks, I think there was soil, like actual topsoil, but then there was probably other stuff added in. Like there could have been some manure or worm castings or, it kind of like it looked like there might have been some maybe not wood shavings, but some type of like a coarser material, like just from the one of the pictures.
Uh-huh.
So basically what I can think of is like it's going to take a few years for that to kind of settle into place. Like when you first, it's just like if you till the soil, it's if you rototill, it fluffs everything up. So if they've sifted that, or if they, you know.
Yeah.
And by the time they dump it all in there, like no matter what you do, it's just going to slump a little bit over the years. And I think it will eventually stabilize. So I guess on yours, because your beds have been established for quite a while.
Yes.
So, and did you just mound soil into it, or how did you build them?
A couple different ways. The first beds, I actually bought topsoil and cut it with manure and brown leaves. And then the other beds, my neighbor is a landscaping contractor, kind of guy, and he has a vast collection of mounds of stuff in his yard. And so he brought down in his tractor some mushroom compost, just some regular compost, and what he called garden soil. And he dropped those in the other beds. And they're actually quite different. I don't want to talk about this further later, but I want to do some soil tests on that. But I think my beds have matured, and a lot of the organic material and the fluffiness is gone now. And so Aaron's are newer and more of the organic material. So, and that organic material is breaking down, and then the soil level drops. I guess that's how it works.
Yeah. And also, I just thinking too, like, because hers are really deep. Like, they're, what is it, like a 2 feeter?
They're tall.
Yeah. So that's the other differences, because yours are more just,
they're about 10 inches high.
Yeah. So that's the other thing too. Like if hers are, say, even like, like if they're 4 times the height, well then, you know, like say a 1 inch drop on your beds would be like a 4 inch drop on hers. And I think that's what she said, was about a 6 inch, or they dropped about 6 inches or something like uh-huh. that. Yeah. So. Now that would be the good solution. Like if there's the other thing where she'd said that there could be what was it, like a water line or sewage line or something burst, or if there was some other thing going on deeper down, that could be a problem. But I would think if it's just that, then I think it's just natural that they're gonna drop. So
all right.
So yeah, that's what I would say.
A quick aside, your microphone's a little hot. Could you move your microphone like 6 inches away from you?
Okay. How is that there?
That's good.
That's good there? Okay, I'll stay there.
I have my garden beds, and I just, my neighbor came over in the fall, and he has a super duper lawnmower, one of those ones that looks like it goes on a golf course. And he chopped up all my leaves in the yard, and it has like 6 blades on this thing, and drops it into this hopper. And then he just took the hopper and dumped it on the side of my yard. And I have this beautiful pile of brown leaves that are super chopped up. And I thought that would be a really good soil amendment for the raised beds. First, is that a good idea in your opinion? And should I just lay it on the top, or should I mix it in?
It will take some of your nitrogen away, like because they were all brown leaves.
Yeah.
When they fell, yeah. So it will take some of the nitrogen. Over time it would eventually come back, but initially it might tie some up because they are brown. They're higher C to N ratio.
Uh huh. Higher carbon to nitrogen.
Carbon to nitrogen, yeah. So, and just for anybody listening, like if a grass is a low carbon to nitrogen ratio, so that's where when you mix those, or any green material, when you mix them together, you get a nicer compost going on there. Probably you wouldn't want to mix them in. If you could use them more as like a mulch on the top, that'd be probably the best.
All right, because that's what I've been doing, but I just didn't know whether turning it in would be better for some reason. And you are the expert.
Eventually, they'll just make their way into it, right?
Yeah, I think the worms bring them down.
Yeah, they do. So, so that's actually good. That's the best way, is that if they stay in place, then so you can actually put them on top of the bed and they'll stay in place, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
they're okay, not going anywhere. I can't do that here.
What happens?
We get these, the winds here are just something else. Like, I'll put it in miles per hour. We could have days of 30 to 40 mile per hour winds with gusts to 50 and or so, like where it'll just blow for days and it's a dry wind.
Oh, wow.
They come down off the Rocky Mountains. They're locally around here, they call them Chinook winds, because I think they came from a, an indigenous tribe area that was were known as the Chinooks at one time, or something like that. So, but they're common all through southern Alberta and then northern Montana. And when they blow, they really
They take all your mulch.
they do. And I mean, and where I am is, it would be probably about would it be about 120 or so miles from the mountains, but closer to them they blow even harder. And we had there was it was a year ago, I'm just calculating it out. They had a gust of 110 miles per hour
Oh, geez.
that blew over the wind sign, they have warning signs on the highways,
Right.
because transport trucks get blown over with these. Once they're up to a certain level, they can get blown off the highway. So I've even had well, that's why I had wood mulch in my garden for quite a while,
Yeah.
because even compost, like even if I spread compost on the top of my garden, it could get blown away. So the wood mulch was the only thing that I could find that would stay in place. Nothing else would stay. So
Wow, I'm not complaining.
it's quite the it's quite the thing. And I mean, our area, like there's a reason why there's not many trees around here, and probably our tallest trees are, well, maybe 30 feet or 40 feet,
Yeah.
because trees just don't last here. So
In the before we started the show, you said that you wanted to talk about some local soil amendments. I'm curious about that.
well, yeah, and I guess that what was my idea, or what I was thinking was, is that it's is just for when you're looking, because I think Erin, because she had asked about getting soil amendments or what she thought might work for her beds. I think that was one of her questions. And it, like, basically my thought was, is that the more local you can get, the better. Or it's, the motto, use what you've got. So I guess as an example, so that was why, like with the wood mulch, even though we don't have a lot of trees around here, there is at our local dump, or the town, they have a wood mulch pile that anybody can take from, and they get it from, picking up trees that have blown down or trimmings or whatever. And then town residents, when they do yard cleanups, you can send them there and they turn them into wood mulch. So, I mean, I use that because they're charging now for it, but oh no, they're not charging for it, but if you want the loader to come and dump a whole load into the back of your truck, they charge you
Oh,
$20.
okay.
But even then, so it's free,
Yeah.
basically. So that's what I use. And just like Rick going around and picking up bags of leaves in the fall,
Yeah.
I do that too. And I fill up my I have a pallet bin and fill that up, and then just slowly make my compost over the course of the year, just throwing in any kitchen scraps, any of the veggie scraps, and that in there with a little, like in a separate bin with a little bit of leaves, and just keep working on it. So, because if you get, if you're at a garden center or someplace, sometimes those, like by the time if you look at buying some of those amendments, it can get pretty pricey after a while. So it's more just looking around and seeing what you have locally. And I don't even know what other places would have, but in terms of amendments, it's more about getting the organic matter in there.
We have a grass-fed dairy farm near us, and they are incredibly enterprising. And it's a self-sustaining farm. They have their own biodigester. They have a huge solar field, solar farm, and from the manure from the cows after they, and they also make Maybe you've seen them in catalogs. They're called cow pots. They're these degradable plant pots that are made. They're from right down the road here. But they have a farm and garden center where you can buy bagged cow manure that's been aged, pasteurized. But you can also just, if you go over there with your pickup truck, for the price of maybe four bags of the bagged compost, they'll give you a truckload. You know, they have a skid steer with a scooper with a front end loader. And I think it's one drop of that is like $20. So again, much like the wood chips, it's kind of a, you know, what's nearby and go borrow your buddy's truck and then, you know, fill the gas. When you bring the truck back, clean it out, fill it with gas and maybe a six pack of his favorite beer or something, you know, so he'll let you borrow it next year. But the carbon footprint of that is so much lower than buying bagged materials, you know, because the bagged materials, they're coming on a semi truck from halfway across the country, maybe, you know?
Yeah, and that's one of those, that I think that's kind of what my point is that you just got to look for what you have. Because I think you even said like mushroom, or that neighbor of yours that had the mushroom.
Yeah, mushroom compost.
Yeah. So, and I was even just thinking of, even if you are buying stuff, like look for stuff that is local or somewhat, or, you know, as sustainable as you can find it. Cause I've got, I'm just thinking of like that peat moss. For some sources of peat moss are sustainable. So, you know, it's not as bad as like, this is my example, is like with peat moss, people will avoid peat moss and then they'll buy a cocoa core that's coming from halfway across the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, sure, it's a waste product that they found another market for, but imagine shipping all that all over the place. So.
Yeah, it's got a big footprint there, a lot of gas and a lot of diesel.
I guess you'd have to evaluate each source, but, or even I've heard people talk about, another big amendment is fish products or fish, you know,
fish emulsion,
fertilizers and all that type of stuff. But for where I am, I wouldn't think anybody in the interior of the country, unless there's fishing or, you know, a local source of it, having it trucked all the way from the coast. I'm not sure if that's it's not very carbon friendly. I wouldn't think so. I guess that's my point. You don't go after what everybody's using, just find what you got around close to you.
I've also read from a reputable source. It's the, it was one of these sustainable fishery websites, is that this demand for the fish emulsion, which is ground up fish as a fertilizer, has caused part of the overfishing problem, because there are some companies that are going out with boats just to haul in fish and grind them up for fish emulsion, where the idea originally was what the non-desirable parts of the fish are processed out at the fish processing facility, and those are ground up and sold to gardeners. But now they're actually like yanking them out of the ocean just for the fish fertilizer, and that doesn't work for me. So,
yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking is that, yeah, it's you know, if you've got, even locally, like say you go fishing and you have some extra, or you have the leftover parts, well, sure, it's, you know, it's probably a good fertilizer.
Yeah.
And if you're close to a good source, then why not? But now that if it's transitioned to specifically going out to fish to make it into fertilizer, maybe it's not the best thing anymore.
No. Hey, would you like more of Garden Fork or more of Eric? Would you like to get it in your email inbox? I send out just about every week, I send out a little email about Eric's world and new stuff I posted. I even talk about podcasts I've listened to or just interesting stuff. And usually, almost always, at least one picture of the Labradors, Henry and Charlie. You can get that by signing up for Eric's Garden Fork email newsletter thing. There should be a link in the notes to this show. Just scroll down to the description of the podcast in your app, and I hope it's a clickable link. It should be. Or go to gardenfork.tv, and on almost every page, at the top of the page, should be a sign up. If you're on a mobile device, you might have to tap on the little, there's a little menu bar, and then hopefully there it'll be a sign up, or scroll the bottom of a post and you can sign up there. Should be a link in the app here. More of Eric. It would be fun to have you along for the ride. It's kind of more brain dump Eric. Cool stuff. All right. So I have some rudimentary questions about soil tests. In the States, at least, in certain states of the United States, you can send your soil to the local agricultural extension or a university, and it's, I don't know, it's $15 a test or something, a little plastic bag you send in. Is there different levels of soil testing, and does your average backyard vegetable gardener need a super in-depth test, or what kind of level of testing do they need, and where do they get it?
I think, again, it's best to be as local as you can, because each area or each soil has different or is made up differently depending on what the parent material is that it was formed from.
Yep.
And so just on the from the agricultural side, you put like if somebody gets a soil sample and uses a lab a few provinces away or states away, they may not be using the best extractants to pull out the nutrients. Mm-hmm. to try to figure out what's in there, so you may not be getting good results. So and in terms of testing, like, I think that's where, like, that, I don't think you need to spend a lot of money on it. So it's probably not a bad thing to have, maybe once, but most gardeners, I go by more of an observation. You know, I observe what I'm seeing and then decide whether I need to add any, or you add a little fertilizer to an area and see if they need to add any more. Go on that, because it's such a small scale. So, though I've heard stories, at least, of people who are, some gardeners, they've taken soil tests and they've been excessive in nutrients because they've put so much manure or compost or other stuff down over the years that they actually have built up their nutrients too high. So that could be a place where having a test tells you whether you're too high or too low.
They're redlining the meter. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, so, well, and I know that, when people have calculated out how much the average lawn gets for fertilizer, it's way, like, it's twice or three times or more what would actually go on in an agricultural field. Like, it's,
oh wow,
you know, I guess on those perspectives, like, when you're looking at, say, 100 pounds per acre of a fertilizer, if you draw that down to a yard level, it comes down to, you know, maybe a pound for a whole yard or a whole, you know, piece of ground. And, you know, you look at it, you think, oh, that doesn't look like much. So throw some more on. And so that can be a problem. But at least on the agricultural side, there's a huge number of soil health tests that are hitting the market. They're trying to look at things instead of just looking at the chemical, like the right. Nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium. And they're getting closer, but they're still not perfectly reliable. So at least at this point, they're not you can get a number, or it can kind of give you like, it'll give you kind of like this index of how healthy your soil is. But the problem is that it's just a number right now. It's hard to compare it. So I would say, I guess the simple answer is if you have a university or state lab nearby or that you can send the soil into, then just getting one good test would be good. Or if you have different areas of a, maybe a few different areas. But of course, every time you pick a different area, then you're going to be, it raises the cost. But because you're the more tests, the better. But then there's that point of how much you want to get into it. So,
I have
yeah.
a raised bed where I plant my string beans. What are they called? Snake bite? I think it's an heirloom I get from Fedco Seed, snake bite. But last year they didn't grow nearly as well, and I'm wondering, do I need to work on the soil, or do I just need to rotate and put them somewhere else? I think I already know the answer to this, but
Probably if they've been growing in the same place, then it'd be rotate.
there you go.
Yeah.
That was worth a Skype call right there.
Yeah. Yeah, you should always be planting things in different spots. So, and I've changed to try to have, like, instead of having in my garden like, like a big block of say like a block of beans and then a block of tomatoes or like that type of stuff. I've tried to scatter them around so it's a little more diversity in any one spot, but every year I don't want to be planting the same thing on the same piece of ground. So
Oh, that's brilliant. So I could have like a tomato plant and then some beans and then some kale, and in another bed, I could have a different tomato plant. They don't all have to be in the same raised bed.
no,
That's so it's better not
it does
to.
make things a little more complicated. Especially if the next year you're looking at things and trying to figure out where you planted everything the previous year. But I'm trying that because some people are really getting into intercropping
Yes.
on large agricultural fields. The biggest success so far seems to be canola and peas and or mustard. And the peas are the dry peas, like the ones that get like it's not for fresh
Right.
harvest. They're the dry ones. But what people are finding is that well, first of all, if you get the right ratio, then you get the peas will climb up the mustard plants. And they kind of use them at, they kind of use them as a trellis, so they're less contact with the soil and they're a little easier to harvest. And there's some evidence of less pests in them, like less insects, that they don't seem to bother them as much because with having the two crops in there. So
Wow. This kind of, go
I'm
ahead.
trying that, so.
This kind of folds into, I was going to, as the last question of our talk, I was going to ask about what cool things are happening in your world of agronomy, and that's one of them. So people on a commercial scale are experimenting with intercropping. What else, what other cool stuff is going on?
Well, and I think the intercropping is probably one of the neatest ones. And but I think and a lot of it too is it's machinery and separation, because I mean that was always the barrier to intercropping in the past, is now you've got two crops mixed out there, so you gotta separate them out. And but people are the technology has got better and people have come up with ways to do it. And of course, like something like peas and mustard is a really good one. Really easy to separate those seeds
Yes.
later. I would say that's probably the big one. That's the biggest one. And then there's a lot of interest in the regenerative agriculture, like with using cover crops or also what they call companion crops. So it's you still have one crop out in the field, but you have other plants growing in it to help out the crop plant. There's all kinds of experimentation out there, so it's really fascinating.
A while back, you were talking about using your drone to look at the large fields, and then you moved over to satellite imagery. Has there been some changes in that world?
It changes every year. Whenever I go to, like, I'm on the point where I've got to make my decision as to what I'm going to use this year. And every year I find that what a company that I use one year gets bought up by another company, or they were offering one service, but now that service provider or where they were getting their imagery from isn't selling to them anymore, or all kinds of stuff. So it's still kind of a big influx kind of thing. But the drone, and I mean also the drone, like when I was using it, it was kind of like this, new and exciting thing, and everybody was getting into it. And here in Canada, at least, and I think it was even worse in the US, like well, in Canada, they kind of like they were, it went from the only people that could have a drone were really, really highly technical people.
Right.
So they didn't really have to worry about the hobby people. But then as soon as, these things like the DJI Phantom and all those type of ones were hitting the market, all of a sudden they didn't have the regulations in place to even
Yep.
to regulate them, but they were becoming a big problem. So and I found too, like I think it's one of those things, like you're either someone who loves flying those things or not. And
Yeah.
it was fun flying them, and it was really neat to be able to see the fields from, the bird's eye view. But to get good imagery, you really have to be committed to it and spend the time on it.
Right,
And
right.
as people entered in that could do it, then I'd rather just have someone else do it for me.
Outsource it to the expert.
What's that?
So outsourcing it to the expert.
Basically, yeah, and there's people that just, like they love the big, or they're good with spending a whole day doing it. And to me, it wasn't something, it was taking away more time than giving me time. So I just rather have someone else do it and give me the pictures.
Yeah, I like flying the drone, but I don't know if I want to do it all day.
No, and that's the thing. And once, yeah, that was exactly it. That was the thing, is it? And especially too, when the weather is, when you're getting windier days, or threat of rain, and then when you're having technical issues with it, then it starts eating up more time than it's actually helping you with. So.
So this is the part of the show where I look at the Garden Fork page on iTunes and see if we have any new reviews. So I'm gonna see if we have any new reviews. Oh my gosh, we have one, two, we have three new reviews.
Oh, nice.
The first one, is from Cheesehead Bruce, and I know who Bruce is. He's pretty active on the Facebook, the Garden Fork Facebook discussion group. He lives in Wisconsin. And
I would have guessed that.
yeah, Cheesehead. Fun and informative podcast, 5 stars, of course, because that's what Bruce did. My daughter and son-in-law's Black Lab said to give a 5-star rating for Garden Fork Radio. He loves playing with the DIY rope toy I made him that I learned how to make from a Garden Fork video. I remember that, Bruce. The radio show often talks about interesting DIY projects. It's not uncommon for the host of the show to ask for listeners' input because I don't know the answer for radio shows and videos. How cool is that? It's been a show I've listened to for years, and the content and the host keep it interesting. Thank you, Bruce. Next one is from Pete in CT. So Pete is in Connecticut, I think. Great podcast, 5 stars. I accidentally found this podcast looking for a gardening show, but thought, hey, DIY is useful. And in this case, it certainly is. I've learned a lot and appreciate the delivery. Yay. Eric and his guests laid back but informative style. Keep them coming. There you go. One more. Done is better than perfect. 5 stars by Sven Svenhard. I hope I'm saying that right, Sven. Hey, Eric and friends, I've been waiting for a good time to sit down and write a proper review about Garden Fork and what it means to others and myself. And I figured done is better than perfect. Yes, just start writing the review and it will flow from your fingertips. I seem to always listen to your podcast when I'm en route to do something that might be stressful. Huh? And your podcast offers some relief when I am in that kind of moment. Wow. Listening to your show is like hanging out with friends and solving the world's problems over a cup of coffee, which sometimes gets a little mad science-y, but I love it. Thank you and keep up the good work, Steve H. Wow, that's great. Not bad, huh?
Yeah, those are great ones. And now there's a gardening episode in here for the guy that was looking for a gardening show.
Yes. So, Pete, here's your garden show. And Scott, do you have a podcast?
Yeah, I do. It's called Plants Dig Soil.
Oh. Yeah. Why did I not know about that? For some reason that just dropped into my head. All right.
I renamed it recently because it was the name that I had was kind of long, and so as I was actually, it was over Christmas break. It was just the name came to me that would work. So
I love that kind of thing. I love that kind of, like, it just kind of hits you when you least expect it.
Yeah, and actually that my business or my consulting, I set up my business as that name, and well, of course, I checked the website first and it was available and nobody else had used it, so I got it and it works.
That's brilliant. So if anyone wants to find you, they should go to the Plants Dig Soil podcast then?
Yep. Yeah, and the website is the same. So
I love that.
And just make sure that they have an S after the plants, because for some reason I've had people not catch that, but
Yeah, Plants Dig Soil podcast. Yep. Multiple plants. Cool. All right. Well, thank you everyone for listening. Scott, thank you for your perseverance in getting me to commit to something. That's actually an accomplishment in itself.
Well, and now I've learned how to get onto the show more often. So just tell you when to do it.
All right, everyone. Go out and do cool stuff and make it a great day. Thank you for listening. Garden Fork Radio's executive producer is Jimmy Gutz. You can find more information about Jimmy and the custom hollow books he makes at hollowbooks.com. Our theme music is used under license from uniquetracks.com. Other music used in the show is used under license from audioblocks.com.